Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but don't you...
Yeah, baby. Started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dora Williams singing the Solartopia song with Pete Seeger, David Burns, and the Rivertown Kids on the Grammy Award-winning Rivertown Kids album, Tomorrow's Children. That's what it's called, Tomorrow's Children with the Rivertown Kids. Pete Seeger, David Burns, and Dora Williams. We are back today for another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Hour. Back with one of our favorite guests, the indomitable and irreplaceable and totally indefatigable Kevin Camps, to catch us up on all the latest developments in nuclear power. About 40 minutes out, we're going to be joined by Donna Gilmore from Southern California, also indomitable, irreplaceable, and indefatigable. She is working on the decommissioning of the San Onofre nuclear plant. But there have been a lot of new developments in the world of atomic energy in our desperate campaign of that part of the human race is all concerned about surviving on this planet to shut down all of these commercial reactors. Still have 99 in the United States, 400 or so worldwide. We did have a tragic event in the past week. The Sendai reactor in Japan was reopened by the fascist Shinzo Abe regime, forcing the first reactor to reopen in well over a year in Japan. I was in Japan in the 1970s when there was a lot of talk about Fukushima, a lot of talk about the possibility of a disaster at a nuclear plant surrounded by earthquake faults and in the tsunami zone. And of course, the utility industry said it would never happen. Everything would be fine. And we know what it is. Kevin Camps, you are with Beyond Nuclear. You are on the case all the time. What's your feeling here about what happened at Sendai and what else is going to happen in Japan that we need to know about?
Hey, Harvey, thanks for having me again. Yeah, the Sendai restart's really incredible in a number of ways. So first of all, they restarted on August 11th. So it was right on top of the 70th anniversaries of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki atomic bombings. And then a few days after they restarted, just like the anti-nuclear movement of Japan had warned, including Greenpeace International, Greenpeace Japan, a volcano just 31 miles away, Sakurajima, a mountain, began to really heat up. And it went to a very high level of volcanic eruption emergency alert status, and they started to evacuate people at its base. And granted, the nuclear plant's 30 miles away, but as Greenpeace International has reported, volcanic ash in large amounts coming from that volcano could do some things to that nuclear plant. For one thing, the seismic tremors could knock out the power of the grid. The volcanic ash could knock out the emergency diesel generators because they need air to operate. And if they don't replace those air filters quickly, then those diesel generators don't work. And they don't have plans on the books to do that. The risk of the volcanic ash is that the roof of the high-level radioactive waste storage pool at Sendai is not designed to bear that load of heavy volcanic ash on the roof, so it could collapse.
Well, that's reassuring. So, let's see, the Japanese have managed to build nuclear plants. They had 54 at the peak before 3/11/11 when the Fukushima was devastated. So, we have earthquake faults, we have tsunami zones, we have volcanic ash, we have cyclones, and they certainly have cyclones in Japan, major seaborne storms, hurricanes, and tornadoes, all of which have made appearances at various nuclear plants around the world. And now we add to the mix the thrilling dimension of volcanic ash coming down. What have we missed here? Meteorites? I guess so.
in addition to the volcano that's actually active as we speak, and it's active all the time, but this level of eruption warning is higher, much higher than normal. It's a very serious warning. But another thing about Sendai is there's multiple volcanoes nearby. So they have what are called calderas, which Green Action in Kyoto, Eileen Miyoko-Smith, refers to as super volcanoes. They're just giant depressions in the earth that mark where ancient volcanoes went off. And so there's five of those, and they're even closer to Sendai than this active volcano right now. They're 40 kilometers or 25 miles away. So, yeah, I mean, like you said, typhoons, for example, hitting the Fukushima Daiichi site have been responsible for overflows of highly radioactive water into the ditches, into the ground, and into the ocean. And those have been some of the worst releases in recent years at Fukushima Daiichi, is the typhoon flood, for lack of a better word.
So how many more reactors are on the near-term shelf here for Shinzo Abe to reopen? I mean, are there others coming down the pipeline at us?
They have the one restarted. They have another one on the same site that they want to restart in October. And in addition to that, there are three other reactors in the country that have the green light from the Japanese Nuclear Regulation Authority. So that's five reactors green-lighted to restart. There's another 20 that have applied for restart permission. So that's the pipeline, is 25 restarts in the not-too-distant future, despite, you know, the Herculean effort by the Japanese anti-nuclear movement to stop it. They've stopped it for over 4 years now, you know, so it's been a miracle because this industry is so powerful in Japan. But this is the first restart under the new rules post-Fukushima. But as Greenpeace Japan has pointed out, these new rules, which Abe and his head of the Nuclear Regulation Authority brag up as the best nuclear safety regulations in the world, are not that. It's a lie, actually. The IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, has stronger volcano rules. So does, incredibly enough, because we know how bad they are, but the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission has better volcanic ash rules than Japan is applying at Sendai. And the worst implicated at-risk reactor in the U.S. to volcanic ash is Columbia Regenerating Station in the Northwest.
Right, that's where the region where Mount St. Helens went off several years ago, and God forbid that should happen again when we have nuclear reactors operating. We're talking with Kevin Camps here from the Nuclear Beyond Nuclear Organization. Let's come to the United States now, Kevin. I spoke 2 days ago in Wellfleet, Massachusetts, and a couple days before that in Watertown, a suburb of Boston. And one of the big things that's happening in the attempt to shut the Pilgrim reactor is challenges to the water quality situation. Now, when you have once-through cooling, which means that the water is taken out of the ocean or the lake or the stream and then it's put right back in without cooling towers, that water goes back into the body of water, the cooling water goes back into the body of water much, much hotter. And this is a big issue now at Diablo Canyon in California, and in at Indian Point in New York, and it has won us an apparent shutdown date, December 31st, 2019, at Oyster Creek in New Jersey. So update us, Kevin. What is happening on water quality issues? I know that you just told me before the show it's become an issue at some reactors in Canada. So explain for us, if you will, the water quality issue at nukes and how it breaks down between state and federal authority.
Sure, yeah. The impacts on surface waters by nuclear power and also by fossil fuels that especially lack cooling towers is quite dramatic, because these central thermal electric plants, whether splitting atoms or burning fossil fuels, are very inefficient to start with. So only a third of the heat that they generate is actually converted into electricity. And two-thirds of the heat is just waste heat, and they got to get rid of it somehow. And so a lot of these plants saved money decades ago, did not build cooling towers, and are just dumping their superheated wastewater into these surface waters. So it's having a, you know, terrible impact on the natural ecosystems of these places. You mentioned Diablo Canyon, and my coworkers Paul and Linda Gunter did a report entitled License to Kill. And what was once a underwater oasis of biological diversity, like a rainforest on the ocean floor in Diablo Cove in California there, is now just bare rock because the water coming out of Diablo Canyon's two reactors is 25 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than the ocean water. And so they just scalded this cove that was so full of biological diversity. And it's not the only place. I mean, you mentioned Oyster Creek, an incredible factoid that I learned from the defenders of Barnegat Bay, is that once every 6 weeks, the Oyster Creek reactor consumes, for cooling purposes, every cup full of water that there is in the bay. Every 6 weeks, the entire bay passes through the Oyster Creek nuclear power plant to cool it. And the impacts, the reason for that title, License to Kill, is that, you know, if you've got microscopic life forms in the water, like the larval stages of fish or shellfish, and even, you know, megafauna, actual fish, are getting sucked into these nuclear plants, and of course they die, and they get kind of disgorged as this formerly living material, which is now this organic sludge, that itself has impacts on the ecosystem. Of course, all those critters dying is a great tragedy and crime, and it has tremendous impacts on populations of fish. So if you're talking like Millstone in Connecticut, I believe it's the shad, are very much harmed by the Millstone nuclear power plant. Like a huge fraction of their population is just wiped out by this once through cooling. And then at Indian Point on the Hudson River, the figures are like billions of individual fish per year are being killed if you count the larval stages of these fish. So you know, you get to see now how some of these species are in dramatic decline and even threatened or endangered.
Well, the California, someone on either the California Water Quality Board or the Coastal Commission referred to Diablo Canyon as California's largest marine predator. And what's interesting now, and there was a hearing in the at San Luis Obispo on August 5th, and I talked to one of the officials of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and I asked him if the California Water Boards, either the Coastal Commission or the Water Quality Board, said that Diablo was in out of compliance, which they obviously are, with state water regulations. I asked this guy from the commission, could the state shut the nuke and circumvent the federal laws that have generally, you know, created this huge wall of steel around these nuclear plants in legal terms? And he said basically that the state does have the power to shut Diablo Canyon. But we're seeing at Indian Point, for example, where they also do not have cooling towers, that the state of New York, the governor and the attorney general, are in court trying to shut Indian Point because it's not in compliance with state law, and they're not winning. I mean, what's going on here?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I learned a lot about, you know, state versus federal jurisdictions when it comes to nuclear power from the Vermont Yankee case, where it was Entergy Nuclear versus the state of Vermont in federal court. And so it turns out that going back decades at Diablo Canyon itself, it's a court case referred to as Pacific Gas and Electric for short. And it is the settled law of the land because the Supreme Court issued this ruling. And it unfortunately gave carte blanche, total jurisdiction over radiological safety to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And that's very unfortunate because they're a rogue agency captured by the industry they're supposed to be regulating. But there are other areas like surface water impacts that the Supreme Court recognized states have jurisdiction over. And so you're seeing it more and more, like you said, at Diablo Canyon, California, at Indian Point, New York, at Oyster Creek, New Jersey. The states are asserting their jurisdiction to protect surface waters against these abuses, and it's leading to reactor shutdowns. Oyster Creek, unfortunately, Governor Christie allowed Oyster Creek to violate the Clean Water Act for 10 years in exchange for shutting down 10 years early. And it just really floored me that you can violate a law for 10 years if you're the nuclear industry. I thought we were supposed to be a country of rule of law, but they're breaking the law at Oyster Creek as we speak.
Well, we know Chris Christie's attitude towards law.
Yeah, I lost you there, Harvey. I'm not hearing you. Hello? Hello?
Coal plants, new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Solar Tokyo is home sweet home to me.
Hello, Kevin.
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, so Chris Christie is violating the law allowing the utility that owns the nuclear plant at Oyster Creek to violate the law. My understanding is that Oyster Creek is scheduled to shut down on December 31st, 2019, and they're running until that time without cooling towers, which should be required. But it's not. Now, in Indian Point, the governor of the state of New York, Andrew Cuomo, with the with Schneiderman, the attorney general, they're in court trying to get the feds to shut Indian Point because Indian Point is not in compliance with water quality on the Hudson River. Is that correct?
I believe so. The state of New York Department of Environmental Control has been asserting for years now that Entergy Nuclear, if they want to get that license extension, 20-year license extension, then they're going to have to build cooling towers, which will cost hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars. So the state of New York is fighting the license extension on multiple fronts, including helping lead the effort to challenge NRC's nuclear waste confidence policy. And that's back in federal court at the D.C. Circuit, which is the second highest court in the land, right under the Supreme Court. So my hat's off to the governor and attorney general of New York. They're doing the right thing on multiple fronts.
Right, but to my knowledge now, that's the only governor and attorney general pair that we have in our camp here who have gone to federal court. And it's essential that we do that. Now, I spoke to these two groups in Massachusetts about the Pilgrim plant. Pilgrim is also once through cooling. It's also a marine predator. But we don't have the governor on our side in Massachusetts. We don't have the governor yet on our side in California either at Diablo Canyon, which is also out of compliance with state and federal water quality laws. So
well, another governor and attorney general pair is Vermont, and they just filed yet another lawsuit, the Public Service Board of Vermont did, against the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for letting Entergy Nuclear at Vermont Yankee, which is permanently shut down, raid the decommissioning fund to a huge chunk of the decommissioning fund to pay for things that they're not supposed to use that money for, like irradiated nuclear fuel, storage and management, and even tax payments to the local county. So they're just shamelessly raiding the decommissioning cleanup fund at Vermont Yankee, and Vermont's not standing for it.
Well, obviously, the Entergy, the owner of Vermont Yankee, has the same attitude towards the decommissioning funds that the Republicans in Congress have towards Social Security. There's money lying around. Why not take it? That's coming from someone, by the way, who's on Social Security, so I take it very personally. And Kevin Camps, you've raised this issue of decommissioning here, but let's get back to that in a minute. You told me before the show that there's now a once-through cooling issue with reactors in Canada. Bruce, can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the Bruce Nuclear Generating Station is the largest nuclear power plant operating in the world. There's a total of 9 reactors on this site in western Ontario. It's on the Lake Huron shoreline, so it's right across from the tip of Michigan Sum, about 50, 75 miles across Lake Huron, and they have no cooling towers there. And a Canadian colleague who's a close neighbor to the plant and a, you know, fierce opponent to the plant, Jutta Spletsuter, she's a Green Party candidate for the Ontario Provincial Parliament. She just laid the figure on me, which makes sense, actually. When you've got 8 operable reactors, they have an old prototype that's been long shut down, but they have 8 operable, full-sized, CANDU reactors, thousands of megawatts electric altogether, and they're using 15 billion gallons of Lake Huron water per day to cool those reactors. And that's, you know, par for the course. When you look at Calvert Cliffs 1 and 2 in Maryland on the Chesapeake Bay, they're using, I think the figure is something like 3 billion gallons per day of Chesapeake Bay water to cool those 2 reactors. And that works out to be a square mile of the Chesapeake Bay to a depth of 14 feet. That's how much of the bay they're using every day to cool. So, yeah, the impacts on the natural ecosystems, the natural species of fish and other life forms are just devastating.
Well, and obviously, Bruce, they're not going to force them to build cooling towers. But Bruce, those are old reactors. You're talking about 6 of them. You're talking about Stephen Harper, an extreme right-wing thug, basically, in charge of the Canadian government. Are all 6 reactors operating at Bruce?
Well, there's actually 8 operable reactors. I think 6 are currently operating and 2 are under major refurbishment. But the reason they're doing the refurbishment is so they can keep going for very long license extensions. They plan on operating Bruce for decades to come. And the latest outrage at Bruce, we just had a rally in Port Huron a couple days ago, right on the border. They want to dump all of Ontario's low and intermediate level radioactive waste at the Bruce site, a mile from the lakeshore. That's 20 reactors worth of waste, because you've got a dozen reactors east of Toronto that have been shipping their waste there for 40 years. An old abuse that still goes on is they incinerate all of the low-level waste, and so the emissions from that are undoubtedly nightmarish. And now they want to bury the low-level ashes left over and the intermediate-level radioactive waste, some of which is so hot that it's equivalent to high-level waste and radiological hazards. They want to bury it in this underground facility called the Deep Geologic Repository. And, you know, truth be told, it's all a bait and switch. They want to also put the high-level radioactive waste dump for all of Canada, including high-level waste from New Brunswick and Quebec, in the same dump site, or at least very nearby. So we're fighting that tooth and nail right now.
Oh, my God. All right, so let's talk about radioactive waste now. You've been dealing with a lot of it on the shores of the Great Lakes. You've had some rallies, Kevin Camps, from Beyond Nuclear. Fill us in on what's going on with radioactive waste in the Great Lakes region.
Well, you know, the way I put it is the United States nuclear power industry is crazy enough to make high-level radioactive waste. It's crazy enough to store it on the Great Lakes shores, but it's not crazy enough to bury it on the Great Lakes shores. Although if Bruce and Ontario Power Generation set this precedent, then I would not put it past U.S. nuclear power utilities to try to do the same. In fact, there's a secretive study at the U.S. Department of Energy called Deep Borehole Disposal on site. And they're looking at, you know, various geological formations for doing this, including, I'm sure, on the Great Lakes shorelines, where they would just dig a very deep hole and drop these canisters down. They claim it would be outside of the biosphere, but, you know, we live on planet Earth. I'm not sure there is any outside of the biosphere on this small planet. And of course,
Mars is outside the biosphere. The moon is outside the biosphere, maybe, although we're not sure of that.
Yep.
The Lovelace twins, it's outside the biosphere, except maybe Donald Trump.
Yeah. Well, we've got dozens of our own reactors on the U.S. side of the Great Lakes that are reactor accidents waiting to happen, radioactive waste accidents waiting to happen. The pools are full at all of these sites. The dry casks are poorly designed and poorly made. These are the outdoor silos because the pools have long been full. So they can't put any more waste in the pool. So the overflow parking, like at Palisades in southwest Michigan, are these concrete and steel silos that are themselves 150 yards from the water of Lake Michigan in violation of NRC earthquake safety regulations.
Oh, man, it just never ends. Now, you, we have some additional issues coming up. John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, has become starting to get the usual, syncopated, Coke-sponsored, good reviews, totally unwarranted, of course, from the Fox and other corporate media. He is, to my mind, the obvious Republican choice for vice president to run with either Marco Rubio or Jeb Bush. I would give them Florida and Ohio. Democrats would have no chance to beat them. Now, in Ohio, we have the Davis-Bessie nuclear plant. Kasich, of course, a friend of First Energy, which owns Davis-Bessie, the most dangerous, the most decrepit, the most insanely a falling apart reactor in the country. Kevin, tell us the latest about what's happening at Davis-Bessie near Toledo.
Yeah, Davis-Bessie, which has had more close calls with catastrophe than any other atomic reactor in the United States, also happens to have a severely cracked containment shell. The concrete containment shell called the shield building is severely cracked, and it gets worse every time it freezes at that site, which is, probably tens of times per year in the autumn. And, it's not really the deep freeze so much as it is the freeze-thaw-freeze cycle, which makes the cracking worse. It gets worse a half inch every time it freezes out there. So, it's really a catastrophe waiting to happen, because if they have a meltdown inside Davis-Bessie, the containment is not going to hold the radioactivity in. It's going to probably collapse. The shield building is either going to breach or simply collapse because it's so badly cracked. So, if this $3 billion money grab by First Energy fails, my hope is that that reactor will be shut down.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. We have talked about this before on the show, but people need to know about this. The First Energy, the owner of the Davis-Bessie nuclear plant, which, if this was a car, you wouldn't drive it. If it was a house, you wouldn't live in it. I mean, this thing is just falling down around our shoulders here. And the owners of Davis-Bessie, First Energy, have gone into the Ohio Public Utilities Commission and asked for a $3 billion bailout to keep Davis-Bessie operating and to keep a 50-year-old coal burner called the Samus plant operating, even though neither one of them can compete in the energy market. And you have all these Republicans who are always yapping about the free market economy. And, I would venture to say that virtually every nuclear plant in the country would shut down if we actually had a free market in energy. But the Davis-Bessie is really at the bottom of the heap here. And they're saying, oh, no, we need the power. It's going to be a good deal for the ratepayers. I mean, this plant opened in the late 70s? And it's absolutely insane what they're doing here. And, of course, we haven't heard open endorsement of this rate theft from the governor, who is, of course, now running for president. But God help us if Davis-Bessie is underwritten for another 20, 30 years. It's just, you and I both know, and I hope most of our listeners know, it ain't going to make it. I mean, it's like driving a car up the hill that's 50 years old and hasn't been worked on.
Another big issue at Davis-Bessie where it's not going to make it is embrittlement of the reactor pressure vessel. So it's also on a short list of the worst embrittled reactor pressure vessels in the country, which is a problem especially with pressurized water reactors where the neutron radiation bombardment makes the metal of the reactor pressure vessel, which is the primary boundary to keep the radioactivity inside, brittle. And so if they ever activate the emergency core cooling system, it would be like a hot glass under cold water, only you got to add a ton of pressure per square inch, because that's what's going on in there. And you could breach that vessel and forget about it. You've got a loss of coolant accident, which almost happened to David Spessy in 2002 because of the hole in the head fiasco. You lose the coolant, it turns to steam, it melts down, and if containment fails, which is almost guaranteed at David Spessy, then forget about it. You're going to have large-scale radioactivity releases on the shore of Lake Erie.
You know, I have talked about David Spessy on this show probably six or seven times. I bet the guys in the studio and the women are getting really tired of it, but the fact of the matter is, it's surreal. I mean, you have to wonder about our species' commitment to survival, to keep a machine like this. I mean, of all the machines on the Earth, of all the devices to do whatever we want to have done, none of them surpasses or even matches David Spessy in terms of pure insanity. I mean, this thing is, well, it's embrittled, as you say. It's literally crumbling. They've cut into the containment dome, what, three times to fix this or that? They stuck a new head on the thing.
They had three lids in one decade, which is pretty remarkable. The second lid only lasted from 2004 to 2011. It lasted for 7 years. So if that happens again, we're looking at yet another, you know, and I'm not saying it will, but if it were to happen again, it would be a 2011 to 2018 time frame, and, you know, it just gets pretty ridiculous after a point.
Ridiculous. I mean, it's terrifying. And you know, I just cannot get over David Spessy. I just hope to God that we get this reactor shut before it blows. And, of course, I did a nine-mile well. I was with a monk in San Luis Obispo. He still has knees. He's in great shape, but I can't walk 9 miles anymore. So I rode a bike out to Diablo Canyon, and this one is surrounded by a dozen earthquake fault, tsunami zone, all sorts of problems. You know, it's mind-boggling to me that we're still having to talk about this, Kevin Camp. So you've also had, what else is on the top burner here with our commercial reactors?
I've been real busy at Palisades in southwest Michigan because it's even worse than David Spessy in terms of reactor pressure vessel embrittlement. And we got a hearing granted to us by an Atomic Safety and Licensing Board at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. That was on June 18th. The company, Entergy Nuclear, appealed to the full commission that ruling on July 13th, and we rebutted by our deadline. So that's all before the commission now. The commission are not our friends. There's four commissioners. There's an opening on the commission right now that's soon to be filled by another kind of revolving door nuclear person. Her name is Jessie Roberson, who used to be at DOE. Most recently, she was head of regulatory affairs at Exelon Nuclear, and Obama, who's, you know, the president from Exelon Nuclear, just nominated her to the NRC. So,
oh, my God. All right. Well, let's sit back. Let's listen to this for a minute. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is supposed to be an unbiased, objective, scientific observer and regulator of the nuclear power industry. And you are telling me that the President of the United States has just nominated to this august body of five regulators a PR person from a nuclear company?
Well, no, she actually has a technical background, and she was head of regulatory affairs at Exelon. So she was the go-between between Exelon Nuclear and the NRC. And when she was at DOE, she was in charge of environmental management, which is cleanup of the weapons complex. She was a deputy secretary, I guess, and that was some years ago. And apparently she, you know, did it fairly decent job when she was there in that regard, but it's this revolving door between the industry the NRC is supposed to regulate and the commission itself that is so disturbing. So back further in her career before her DOE stint, she was at Georgia Power, another major nuclear utility in this country, one of the only ones building new reactors right now. So this revolving door at NRC has been very stark for quite a long time. You have Jeffrey Merrifield from the Commission going to work for the Shaw Group, which builds new reactors, provides those services to the industry. Just after he did a major favor to the nuclear industry, he changed the definition of the word construction under NRC regulations. And all of a sudden, when it comes to doing an environmental impact statement on a new atomic reactor, you don't have to worry about the turbine building or the cooling from the surface water. All you got to worry about in the environmental impact statement is the reactor and its containment, which was this tremendous favor, just grease in the skids for these projects to move ahead even before they had approval to do so.
God, unbelievable. It's still shocking. We have to revisit this. The new nominee by Barack Obama to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is someone who is coming directly from Exelon, which owns, what, 11, 12 reactors?
So she's no, they're more like two dozen. They're two dozen because they acquired Constellation Energy.
So Exelon, and, which owns more than 20%, not more than 25% probably, of the reactors in the country. Someone who is working for them now will at some point in the near future walk out their door and walk into the door of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and we're supposed to rely on this person to regulate the two dozen reactors owned and operated by Exelon.
Well,
somehow, I'm not really
a large coalition of anti-nuclear groups challenged the tenure, I guess you could say, of William Magwood IV on the NRC Commission, who came from Westinghouse Nuclear. He was also a private consultant to the likes of Tokyo Electric Power Company before the Fukushima catastrophe. And then Obama nominated him to the commission, and 100 groups opposed the nomination, opposed the Senate confirmation of William Magwood. And then, just to rub salt in the wounds, William Magwood was courting the Nuclear Energy Agency based in Paris, which is the nuclear arm of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the promotional nuclear promotional agency based in Paris. He was courting a job there as director, actually, of the Nuclear Energy Agency, while still serving at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And so that same coalition of 100-plus groups said, this can't be, this cannot be allowed, and Magwood needs to resign immediately. And he refused to. He served up until July 31st of 2014 at the NRC Commission, and on August 1st of 2014, he flew to Paris, and he became director of the Promotional Nuclear Energy Agency.
We're talking with Kevin Camps, certainly an objective observer of the nuclear power industry from Beyond Nuclear. We're going to be joined in a minute or two by Donna Gilmore from Southern California. Kevin, I welcome you to stay on with Donna. You guys know each other, and Donna's working on the other end of the nuclear chain here, the decommissioning and a burial, God help us, of the San Onofre reactors, and also some very important stuff on dry cask storage and the whole treatment of nuclear waste in the nuclear power industry. This is the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Hour. Thanks to our crew in New York for sticking with us through this. My hair has turned white, and every time I start to talk with Kevin and other people who are really close to the road here on the nuclear power issue, even though I've been doing this for more than 40 years, I never cease to be amazed. I mean, Alice in Wonderland has nothing on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We are hoping. Well, Kevin, let's have a prediction. We're reading now about the Clinton reactors, Exelon about to send us a new regulatory commissioner. Is talking about possibly shutting the two reactors at Clinton. What do you think about that? This is in Southern Illinois.
Yeah, there's actually 5 reactors in the Exelon fleet in Illinois that are hemorrhaging money, and so they're really on the brink of closure. Some are worse than others, but there's a total of 5 that Exelon has indicated if they don't get a massive bailout to the tune of $1.8 billion from the state legislature of Illinois, then they will close these 5 reactors. And this is imminent as we speak, because they had previously said if they didn't get the money at the expense of Illinois ratepayers by May 31st of this year, then it was all over for those reactors. So here we are, months past that deadline, And there's press reports from the business press that it's just a matter of time before at least one of those reactors goes down.
So I assume the Clinton reactors, one's named Bill and one's named Hillary, right? And the we probably got Monica Lewinsky in the control room there. But are they just blackmailing the ratepayers, or do you think they're serious about shutting down?
Well, they're in deep financial trouble, and they're kind of, it's like a hostage-taking, because the argument by the Exelon Corporation is if we shut these down, thousands of people are going to lose their jobs. So it's up to you, state legislature, and by the way, here's your campaign contribution. So they have a lot of sympathy at the state legislature, but, you know, the state's in serious financial straits itself, and Exelon has just not gotten its way so far. So hopefully, you know, in terms of safety, it would be such tremendous good news for one of those reactors to shut, for all five of them to shut, and it would also be good news for the pocketbooks of the people of Illinois.
Well, we've got the two with Clinton. What are the other two reactors? Out of five or three?
Let's see. I think Quad Cities accounts for two of them. I think Byron accounts for two of them. And I think there's only one reactor at Clinton, although there was a second proposed. It was one of the lead candidates for a new reactor proposal, but it's canceled at this point, which is really
good. All
right,
so news. I stand corrected. There's one at Clinton, two at Quad Cities, and two at Byron. Let's everybody
those are the five.
Offer up a break.
Those are the five in trouble. Those are the five in trouble in Illinois, yep.
Well, let's hope they all go down and really fast. We have shut Zion near Chicago, and Chicago, of course, at one point had 13 operating reactors around it, and we've done pretty well there to keep them under control. Let's hope that they start to go down really, really fast before anything really bad happens. And, of course, this blackmail is going on also in upstate New York. The owners, I believe, of Fitzpatrick, is that right, are demanding more money as well?
It's Ginay, which is the Rochester Gas and Electric. So it's the people of Rochester who are being asked to the tune of tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, to prop up this geriatric reactor that has worse condenser problems than Vermont Yankee ever did and refuses to make major safety repairs. So they're just running that reactor into the ground.
Well, they're running us into the ground and our planet into the ground as well. And the Fitzpatrick reactor up there, of course, is owned by Entergy. And we have Entergy and Exelon. Who are the other major McNew operators? Are those the two biggest in the country?
They are the two biggest, but, you know, they got some competition from the likes of Duke, based in Charlotte, North Carolina, which has acquired recently additional reactors in places like Florida. So it's creeping up in the largeness of its nuclear operations. You know, First Energy is nothing to sneeze at. They've got Perry in Ohio and also Beaver Valley in Pennsylvania. You've got Florida Power and Light, which calls itself Next Era these days, which runs Seabrook in New Hampshire and also Point Beach in Wisconsin on Lake Michigan. You've got Dominion Nuclear of Virginia, which you know, runs Millstone up in Connecticut. So you've got this consolidation going on where nuclear utilities with one or a few reactors are selling out to these big corporations and just this consolidation of reactor fleets.
Hi there. Kevin?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay. And we're joined now by Donna Gilmore from Southern California, so I got Kevin Camps on the road somewhere in the east. I'm in New York, upstate New York, and Donna Gilmore, you're with us from Southern California. Kevin, you were just giving us a wrap-up on the fleet of fleet operators. We have Exelon, which owns, I guess, the most, a couple dozen. We have Entergy, which owns, what, about a dozen now?
Yep, a dozen. Mm-hmm.
And how many does Duke own?
Don't know. I guess around 10, but I don't know that number.
Okay, and I think those are the three major fleet operators, the McNew operators around the country. Are there any others?
Well, you've got, you know, Southern Nuclear out of Georgia, and Georgia Power are the same company, actually. And, you know, they're the ones who dare to build a new reactor with other people's money, taxpayers and ratepayers. So you've got various nuclear utilities that have their claim to infamy. The Tennessee Valley Authority as well, which is firing up a 43-year-old reactor for the first time. So it's brand new, and it's 43 years old. So,
well, that'll be exciting. That's like the 43-year-old virgin, right? Wasn't that a movie about a nuclear plant? Kevin, stay with us if you would. Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear, one of the great activists and experts on the nuclear power issue. We're joined by Donna Gilmore from Southern California. Donna has now become one of our leading experts on decommissioning. And, Donna, you have the great pleasure of having been a great stalwart in the movement to shut San Onofre. You now have the great pleasure of forcing these guys to at least get near doing the right thing. Tell us the latest about what's happening, especially with the issues of dry cask storage at San Onofre.
Yes, I'm working at the state level with the Public Utility Commission, the Coastal Commission, because we do have some legal actions that we can take at the state level. The problem that we face here really is that almost all U.S. Nuclear plants have the same problem, even if they're not decommissioned. The United States utilities have chosen to standardize on storage technology using thin half-inch to 5/8-inch thick stainless steel canisters, and I've learned from participating in NRC technical meetings and other research that these things may start cracking in 20 years. And what that means for San Onofre, we've had fuel loaded since 2003. The Coburg plant in South Africa had a similar component fail in 17 years, and it's thicker than most of the canisters in the United States. It has the same environment as San Onofre and Diablo, onshore winds, right by the coast, frequent fog, surf. I'm looking at we may have 5 years left before we start having leaks in these canisters. So, and what Edison's doing about that is they're just planning to buy more of these thin canisters, and they're ignoring the data that's out there. So they know better now. They know that these things didn't last as long as people thought, that they're not going to last as long as people thought they would. And what makes it even worse is,
haven't we already had some issues with the dry casks at Diablo Canyon?
That was a loading issue, or they loaded incorrectly. I'm not aware of any leaks that they've had. It takes a while before, once you get a crack, where it will go all the way through. What we had at Diablo is EPRI, one of the industry, was hired to take a look at a couple of canisters at Diablo to see if they could find corrosive salts, and if the temperature was low enough on the canister that it would dissolve the salt, and that starts the corrosion and cracking process. The NRC told me last year, it would take at least 30 years before one of those canisters could be cool enough for salts to dissolve. It turned out 2 years. They looked at a two-year-old canister at Diablo Canyon, has all the conditions for cracking. They don't know if it's cracking because they don't have technology. They can adapt to even look at the surface of the canister, let alone the depth of any crack that might be there. And then the vendor, Holtec, Dr. Singh, the president of the company, said that it's not practical to repair these canisters. In the face of millions of curies of radiation, you try and find a crack, then try and repair it, and even if you succeeded in doing it, you'd introduce another factor that could trigger corrosion.
So by testing, they're going to harm the canister. I got to point out, for those of you who are curious about the advanced state of the technology of the nuclear power industry, when Yankee Row was challenged on embrittlement, the company said they couldn't do it. They couldn't check it because they didn't have technology to check it. They wound up shutting down, thankfully.
at Three Mile Island when we argued that there clearly there had been a meltdown. There was no technology to go into the core to find out if there was a meltdown for years. And now, Donna Gilmore, you're telling me that as these reactors shut in, the two big reactors at Sam and Oprah have a heck of a lot of radioactive fuel rods sitting there, they don't have the technology to see if the casks are even standing up properly?
None of the ones in the country that are using the thin cast technology. Now, in Germany, they use thick casks up to 20 inches thick that you can use for storage and transport. Those have been in use for 40 years. They don't have the cracking problem. If anything starts, it self-heals. They line them with nickel, and the exterior has some kind of an epoxy on it. They have double lids, independently bolted lids. And another important thing is with the German cast, they have monitoring for leaks. So you'll know a pressure change in the lids, you'll know well before if there's any potential for leaks so you can address it. In these thin canisters, because they're welded shut, they have no way, they're not measuring helium, they're not checking to see if they're leaking. And the NRC only requires an employee walk around with a radiation monitor on a stick every quarter to see if they're leaking radiation. The plant is active, they've got radiation monitors around, but once they're decommissioning, they're allowing them to shut down, you know, any monitors. It's just crazy. And I've met with the NRC.
Let me get this straight, Donna Gilmore. The monitoring system for spent fuel casks containing the most lethal substances ever created for nuclear reactors that have been shut, it's for somebody to walk around with a monitor at the end of a stick every 3 months?
Right.
That's it?
That's it, yeah. The radiation happens to get far enough to go to one of the monitors that's around the plant, you'll know then. But once the plant's decommissioned, they start shutting all of that down.
Kevin, is that true? Can we confirm this bit of lunacy here?
Yeah, it's true. And to make matters worse, some of the plants like Yankee Row, you mentioned in Massachusetts, or Maine Yankee, or Connecticut Yankee, they have also dismantled the pools. And so this problem that Donna's describing of cracks in the containers holding the high-level radioactive waste, there's really no way to transfer those fuel rods into a new cask. They don't have a pool to do it in. They're going to have to build a hot cell, which would cost a lot of money. And some good news is that we are suing the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, a coalition of 36 groups, the state of New York, the state of Vermont, the Prairie Island Indian Tribe, challenging their nuclear waste confidence policy, pointing out holes in it, like this fact that, you know, once you get rid of the pool, you have no way to transfer the contents of a failing cask into a new cask.
Well, folks, you're listening to a radio show where comic relief is the discussion of the nuclear waste handling situation. Donna, also, we don't have much time left, but I did want you to talk a bit about the fight over the money at San Onofre. There's all sorts of court battles and PUC battles going on now about who's going to pay for the shutdown. Can you give us a bit of a thumbnail on that?
Well, the judge recently, it's kind of shut all that down. I'm not the best person to speak on that. It'd be best to talk to Michael Geary on that, but we're not seeing any movement from the PUC in terms of doing, even though there, a lot of the original interveners said that they want to see the issue reopened. The judge is basically closed that off, and in her ruling, she said that, no one is to submit any more evidence or ask Edison any more discovery questions. So, so that's the bulk of what I, now I'm in a different decommissioning proceeding. My first time as an intervener. It's a very painful process and very lot of workload, but Edison wants $1.3 billion for new spent fuel management, and they want to buy more of these thin canisters, and they want to put them underground or just below ground in an experimental system that's never been used anywhere in the world and that has numerous problems that if we had more time, I could, you know, go into detail on that. So that's one of the things I'm trying to stop. Now, the Coastal Commission is going to hear this in Long Beach in October about this dry storage system. The Coastal Commission has the authority to deny the permit for this system as long as it's in with the Coastal Act rules. So if anybody wants to get involved in this, and I see this whole action is really at California using San Onofre as a way to fight the terrible waste is stored in the United States. Other countries are smarter than us in this area. They use thick cast technology, so, you know, they bought themselves, some more years. You know, none of these solutions are, you know, going to hold up forever, but at least the thick cast ones are maintainable and you get a warning, that kind of thing. So, they, you know, there's no illusion that there's a great storage solution out there. And it's trying to buy us maybe another 100 years. But I see this battle affecting the whole country, not just San Onofre, but this is a good place to fight the fight on this issue. So if anybody wants to get involved and help, we could use some support. They can contact sanonofresafety.org, contact the website, say you're interested, and we can show you how you can help. We need to get the word out on this.
This nuclear waste at San Onofre is right on the ocean. Just as Kevin Camps was talking earlier about the Bruce and Davis Bessie reactors, which are right on the Great Lakes, and this stuff is building up next to our bodies of water all over the world. And of course, as Donna knows and briefly touched on, when it comes time to shut these reactors, these guys don't want to pay. We've seen the decommissioning funds of Vermont Yankee being raided now by Entergy. Exelon trying to hold up the ratepayers of Illinois for more money. Davis Bessie's owners, First Energy, doing the same thing in Ohio. Very quickly, Donna, thank you for urging people to call in and to see. What is your website again?
SanOnofreSafety.org. SanOnofre Safety.
SanOnofreSafety.org. And Kevin Camps, how do people reach you and sign up to work on your issues there?
Yeah, our website is just beyondnuclear.org.
All right. Well, this is coming to the end of another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Hour. I got to tell you, you know, I do a lot of shows on nuclear power. I hope my crew in New York doesn't get tired of this stuff. But, boy, every time we talk about new developments in the nuclear industry, it gets more and more surreal. We are mourning the reopening of the Sendai reactor in Japan. We hope that there are no more reactors opening there. We hope Sendai shuts as soon as possible. We also pray for the stoppage of the construction in Georgia and South Carolina, and this insane reactor Tennessee Valley Authority is bringing online. It's unbelievable. We're down to 99 in the U.S., folks, around 430 or so worldwide, although the ones in Japan mostly remain shut, so it's really under 300. And let's hope that we can turn sooner or later our discussion into a real comedy hour. Thanks again for the crew in New York. We'll be back next week with another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.